Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our program today, we're going to explore work groups crafting public policy behind closed doors in Lansing. How transparent should Michigan's government really be? We'll talk with Detroit News writer Chad Livengood and Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry. But first, when it comes to education in Michigan, one of the biggest challenges is how do we rescue and turn around failing schools? Governor Snyder created and favors the EAA as the solution, the Education Achievement Authority, a new school system for Michigan's worst-performing public schools. Since last fall, 15 schools in Detroit have been run under the EAA, with 10,000 students and 400 teachers. And now the state is seeking to expand the EAA. The Senate's considering a bill to establish it in law and to expand it to 35 more schools around our state. But critics are challenging this. They say there should be solid evidence the EAA is truly helping students before we move ahead with any sort of expansion. We recently talked with one of those critics, State Representative Ellen Cogan Lipton, who's a Democrat from Huntington Woods. Today, we talk with the Chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority of Michigan, John Covington, joins us from their headquarters in Detroit. John, it's good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's good to be here.
So your recent opinion piece in Bridge Magazine put the question right out there. Why do EAA critics want children trapped in failing schools? Why did you feel you needed to say that?
Well, first of all, when you listen to the critics across the state talk about the persistently low-achieving schools and also talk about persistent failure of the Education Achievement Authority, I find it mind-boggling for individuals to make allegations against a very unique approach providing educational programs and services to children who have historically been underrepresented and certainly underserved educationally, as evidenced by the lackluster academic performance that they demonstrate when we took over these schools, and not want to have a system to transform education for these students so they can master the competencies and skills that they need to become college and career workforce ready is somewhat beyond me. And then to say that we need to maintain a system that we know is not working instead of venturing out and looking at new initiatives that either work or that has the possibility to work to provide a great educational experience for these children is just mind-boggling.
John Covington, the critics are saying they're looking for proof that the state school reform system, the EAA, is really helping students. So you have one school year just about wrapped up in these 15 schools under the EAA. What can you tell us about results that you're seeing so far?
Well, first of all, our system is somewhat unique in that we try to move schools away from the traditional paradigm as to how services are provided. That being said, we don't have traditional grade levels, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, so forth and so on. We have instructional levels where curriculum is tightly aligned to not only Michigan model content standards, but to national standards, which would be the Common Core, and international standards as well. And students progress through the instructional levels based on mastery. Whenever they demonstrate that they have mastered the requisite skills to be successful at the next level, they move. And so their movement is not necessarily predicated upon the amount of time that they sit in the seat. Initially, at the outset of the school year, we provide all children with an assessment. We use performance series, which is a nationally normed test, to determine where children are so that we can meet them at the gap. And then we provide them with three additional assessments once per quarter in order for us to be able to chart the growth that they, as well as their teachers, are making in getting or helping them to achieve what we have as a primary goal, 1.5 to 2 years growth in a year. And so when we provided gave the second assessment and made a comparison as to how well they did against the first assessment, we saw some extraordinary growth. We're in the process right now of administering the third assessment, and we predict that we're going to see additional growth.
When you say you saw extraordinary growth, can you give us a sense of what you saw?
Yeah, sure. 20% of the children, 22%, demonstrated that they already made 1 year's growth. And then another 25-30% demonstrated that they were on the trajectory to make one more year's growth. And one of the things that I'd like for your listening audience to understand is in the EAA, we're looking at growth. We're not looking at the percentage of children who demonstrate that they are scoring at the proficient level on the MEEP, on the state test.
Okay.
Our whole goal is to take children where they are and then to have those children experience 1.5 to 2 years' growth in a year. And that's important because when you look at where children are when we get them, when we took 15 schools at the outset in Detroit, and in the 15 schools that we took, less than 18% of those children were proficient in reading. I think 2% were proficient in science. We didn't have any children proficient in writing or social studies. And then all of them, or not all of them, but the vast majority of them demonstrated that they were two or more years behind grade level or below grade level. And so our thing is to get these children as quickly as we can, mastering those skills that they need to have and to move them progressively back toward grade level.
What do you feel have been, now that you've got almost a full school year done, what are some of the things that didn't work out as well as you wanted it to? What were some of the problems that you know need to be addressed going forward?
Well, one thing that we need to address, and we're certainly going to do that, is make sure that our teachers are provided with a comprehensive professional development program that's ongoing. We provided teachers with professional development at the outset of our school year last year, about 30 days, and that's also been ongoing. But I think we need to provide, because our model is so different, is to make sure that teachers are getting the kind of professional development that they need to hone their skills to teach in a student-centered model. That would be one thing.
What can I ask you about security and discipline? Because we saw the reported reports of, in fact, the Detroit News had a report that the first 5 months that authorities documented more than 5,000 discipline-related infractions across those 15 buildings, and that even went up in the second quarter. Disorderly conduct, drug possessions, firearm possessions, physical assaults against staff. How concerned were you and your staff when you saw these reports?
Not very, and that's not to say that we're not concerned about the safety, the health and well-being of children and staff in our schools. We are. But those kind of numbers are kind of typical of urban school districts. Now, if you look at the 15 schools that we acquired, mm-hmm. and look at the culture and climate that's been established in these schools, I think most individuals who will tell you that they're familiar with the schools and that they had an opportunity to be in and out of these schools last year, that the culture, the climate, the safety and well-being of children in these schools this year is far better than it was in previous years. And so, and although those incidents of misbehavior are high and somewhat alarming, I guess, we are very, very pleased at the progress that the schools have made to establish a good climate and a good culture that's certainly conducive to good teaching and learning.
Well, let me ask you this. The numbers that were reported for your first year, how did that compare to what had been reported before you took over those 15 schools? Higher, lower, the same? What was the?
I really can't answer that question, and I'm not trying to be evasive, but I don't really have the numbers available as to what discipline was like in schools last year.
I'm speaking with the Chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority of Michigan, John Covington, who has joined us from their offices in Detroit. John, we've got Democratic critics like Representative Lipton saying that there should be more time to build more evidence that the EAA is truly helping students before expanding into more schools. Do you think saying that, is that equivalent to saying they would rather keep kids trapped in failing schools, as your column in Bridge states? Isn't it more they're asking for more light to be shed on possible problems and for those issues to be addressed before expanding?
Okay. Then what will happen to the children in the meantime? Are we going to send them out to Cranbrook? I equate that with saying, let's keep children in the failing situations in which children are now at no fault of their own being forced to attend school, when we all know that the current system of public schooling for these children is not working. It has not worked for the last several decades, and it's now time for us to make sure that these children have an equitable opportunity to get the best possible education that we can provide them. And while we would never say to you that our way is the only way, we would say to you and be quite emphatic about it that the progress that children have made in a very, very short period of time demonstrate that the Education Achievement Authority of Michigan's model of meeting children where they are with a student-centered approach, moving away from a one-size-fits-all, providing children with an individualized education plan is the best way for us to get it done, and it's working.
We'll continue our conversation with John Covington, Chancellor of Michigan's EAA, and find out what his hopes are for the students in Michigan's failing schools. Then we explore how new technology being developed in Michigan could help authorities identify potential threats. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now, our conversation with the Chancellor of Michigan's Education Achievement Authority, John Covington, who joins us from Detroit. In a recent opinion piece in Bridge Magazine, he posed the question, why do EAA critics want children trapped in failing schools? Democratic Representative Ellen Kogan Lipton is one of those critics, and when she was on our program a few weeks ago, she talked at length about conversations she had with students at Mumford High School on Detroit's Northwest Side. One of the things they talked about was the software package called Buzz. John, can you tell us what Buzz is and what it's designed to do?
Yes. Earlier, I mentioned that all children will have an individualized education plan and that our motto is to meet children where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz should not be confused with curriculum. It is not. Buzz is nothing more than an electronic platform, a tool to help teachers differentiate instruction, provide children with a blended model of educational experiences to help them overcome the deficits that children have. And so all children are not working at the same time nor in the same space. They're not at the same place, and they progress through these levels of instruction based on mastery.
If I could, I'd like to share with you what Representative Lipton told us she heard from Mumford students. I'd like to have you listen to that, and then I'd be very interested in what you have to respond about that. Let me play you this clip.
They said, okay, Buzz is a joke. They said it is demeaning. It is not challenging. We hate to use it. Oh, one of the questions I asked was, you know, do you like your school now? Do you like it better now, or did you like it better before? And they said, we liked it better before. And I said, why? Tell me why. And one little boy, he said, look around this room. He said, do you see any books? And by golly, not a single book in the classroom. And he said, you know what? I really miss my books.
And that was Representative Ellen Kogan Lipton, a Democrat from Huntington Woods, on Stateside a few weeks ago. So, John, have you personally sat down with students to get their thoughts and views on this package? And what were your thoughts after hearing this?
I've not only had the opportunity to sit down and talk with children who are enrolled in Mumford High School, I have had the opportunity to sit down and talk with students in the other 12 direct run schools. And the reason that I say the other 12 direct run, because of the 9 elementary schools that we have, 3 of them are charters.
Okay.
And charter schools are not using our student-centered model.
Okay.
But the children are absolutely, positively, without question, fascinated with Buzz. They're fascinated with the marked improvement that they see in their own learning. Now, I wasn't with Representative Lipton on the day that she visited, or she claimed that she visited the school. But is it possible that she had that conversation with a child at Mumford? Absolutely. Would I sit here and say to you that every single child in the EAA is happy with Buzz? No, I wouldn't. Nor would I tell you that every single teacher is happy with Buzz. But across the district, I can assure you that the overwhelming majority of teachers and children are happy with the move that we've made to make sure that we're meeting children where they are. Now, that's not to say that that's 100% and that you can't come to Michigan or Detroit and visit some of our schools and find two or three students who might be unhappy with it.
Are there books being used, or is it really very much, computer-based and through Buzz? The comment that that there were no books in the classrooms, is that part of this approach?
Well, first of all, in our classrooms, children are allowed to use a myriad of resources to help them get to where they need to get in terms of skill mastery. And so do we have textbooks that we have assigned to every single child? The answer to that is no. Are there textbooks in classrooms that children can use for teaching and learning purposes? Absolutely. And that would hold true in all of our schools. And at the same time, Buzz, in terms of the number of resources, books and open resource materials that children have access to, it is absolutely phenomenal. And we invite anyone to come out to see the platform, to see firsthand how the platform works, and you'll see that children have direct access to a myriad of resources, as well as the teachers, to help them master those skills that they need to master based on standards.
John Covington, when you look at the challenges of schools that are failing all around the state, not just the 15 that you were running now in Detroit, but thinking of children in failing schools, I'd like you to speak not so much as the chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority of Michigan, but as an educator, someone who has embraced teaching and education as your life's calling. What are your personal goals and hopes for those students, and why does it take going outside of traditional school systems to accomplish that?
Well, first of all, public education is not a career. It is my life. And I say that because I found myself once upon a time situated in the same position that a good many of our children in these persistently lowest achieving schools find themselves. Whether we're talking about persistently low achieving schools or whether we're talking about students in schools that we would say are doing pretty good, my thing is, if we expect for our state to become an economically viable state, then we're going to have to ensure that our children are getting what they need to compete against children in Singapore, children in Japan, children in China. And when you look at public schooling in foreign countries and see that they attend school in excess of 220 days, and we're still at 180 days per year, it's absolutely mind-boggling that our country and our state is insistent upon maintaining a system that we should have long since abandoned because it's no longer applicable and it's no longer serving the need of 21st century digital native young people who exit their mother's womb with a cell phone in one hand and a laptop in the other. There is inherently nothing wrong with, particularly for children in persistently lowest achieving schools across the state, is to ensure that we are demonstrating that we're closing the gap by meeting children where they are, moving away from a one-size-fits-all approach to ensure that children are graduating from our high schools, college, career, and workforce ready. For anybody out there who feels that it's okay for a child to graduate high school and we place in that child's hand a diploma that child can't even read and they don't find anything wrong with that, that is something wrong with that mindset.
We've been speaking with John Covington. John is the Chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority of Michigan. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside, John.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And we want to let all of you know the State Board of Education has community public meetings scheduled tomorrow and next week. The idea is to give you a place to discuss current education issues, education reforms, financing proposals, and potential legislation. Meetings will be held in Grand Rapids, Novi, and Okemos. For more information, just go to the Michigan Department of Education website. That's michigan.gov/MDE. In the aftermath of school shootings, theater shootings, bombings, the question of security screening in America has become very, very real and very, very important. But how do we balance privacy concerns and rights with the need to screen for potential threats? And how can we screen smarter and better? A University of Michigan professor is working on that very challenge, building a better security detector. He's a professor of electrical engineering, and he directs the radiation laboratory at the University of Michigan, Dr. Kamal Sarabandi, and he joins us here in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
Well, you've gotten funding from the Department of Defense and from the Army. There's serious interest in what you're doing in terms of developing a long-range radar technology as a means of detecting concealed objects. So explain that. What does that mean?
Sure. See, we are working on a frequency of electromagnetic waves. At this frequency, this is millimeter wave frequencies, the wavelength is very small. It is small so that you can make the sensor that you want to make relatively small. At the same time, it is long so that it can penetrate through clothing. So we are in a very sweet spot of the electromagnetic wave spectrum. At that frequency, basically, the signal can go through your clothing without much attenuation. As it hits the surface of the skin of your body, mm-hmm. the electromagnetic wave reflects. And it reflects, and the receiver in the radar actually detects that signal. So that is very normal and usual way radars usually work.
Mm-hmm.
However, the neat thing about this technology and the innovation that we brought out to make such a sensor work, actually, is based on radar polarization or radar polarimetry technique.
Okay.
Electromagnetic wave, similar to light, have polarization. So that's why, you know, you wear, for example, sunglasses, you know, Polaroid sunglasses,
mm-hmm.
to get rid of the glare. You know, you get a portion of the reflected signal that is, let's say, the glare. It's a specific polarization. You filter that, and that's how you can see. Here, we do a similar thing. We use polarization over the torso of human body. You know, it's very smooth. Electromagnetic wave reflects with the same polarization it was illuminated with.
Okay.
Unless you're wearing something. If you're wearing something, then a phenomenon of depolarization takes place. And we look at the polarization change of the signal that comes back. And that is what it tells us, whether you're hiding something beneath your clothing or not.
Okay. So unlike the body scanners at airports, which continue to raise privacy concerns and people feeling, well, you're going to be seeing my body, this doesn't work that way.
It does not work like that. Actually, we can detect, let's say, a person or scrutinize a person from a distance of about 100 meters away. What we do, we have a single beam of the radar that covers the entire body of the person, for example, you're trying to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
We are not creating any images. We are not looking at any body parts or try to specify, you know, similar to an optical image, whether there is something or not. Here, we are only looking at the polarization difference that comes from the entire body back. There is some neat trick, another trick that I have to explain here we are using. We are using a signal processing technique. As people walk, they create a Doppler spectrum.
Okay.
This is very similar to radar Dopplers that usually meteorologists are using for measuring the amount of rain that
mm-hmm.
comes. You know,
sure.
Everybody has heard about
Doppler
this
weather
Doppler,
radar.
Doppler weather radar. So we are using that Doppler. If you're moving, the frequency of the backscatter signal is changing. If you're approaching, the frequency goes up. If you're receding, the frequency goes down. But it's very interesting that as you walk, a portion of your body moves faster, a portion of your body moves slower as you move your limbs forward and backward.
Okay.
That creates a signature we call Doppler spectrum. that radar Doppler spectrum actually is very specific. It's very specific to human beings. That's how we can distinguish, for example, a stationary object from a moving object,
okay,
a moving object from a human walking. We use that signal processing technique in order to even go a further beyond and basically dissect the radar backscatter from different parts of your body. Basically, we associate which part of the energy is coming from your limbs, which part of the energy is coming from your torso. So we identify that portion that comes from the torso, and we interrogate that in terms of the polarization.
And you would know what to expect. So if there was something being hidden, it would be
a polarization change.
All right. Right. Dr. Sarabandi, where would you give us an idea? And I know that this technology is still being worked on. It's certainly not ready to be mass produced. But what kind of applications in everyday security could you see this system, this radar system being used for?
Yes. Anywhere that you want to look at a large group of people, for example, people who are approaching to come to a stadium is one example, a large crowd that are you want to examine very quickly if there are any problems, you know, identify maybe suspects that may be carrying some stuff. You can pull those people aside and further scrutinize them.
So this could be used at an airport?
At an airport, obviously. You can use it in malls. You can use it in anywhere that you may want to make sure that it's the environment is secure and there is a large gathering of people.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from, or have you gotten any feedback from people that are concerned about the idea of having to have this vigilance and having to screen and having to look at large groups and try to identify
sure
something suspicious?
Sure. Of course, you know, I am not a person who would decide, you know, whether we should do this or not. We are developing the science, and that aspect of I guess the discussion, you know, goes deeper.
Yes.
I have received, you know, yes, some emails. You know, there are, of course, concerns about people who don't want to be scrutinized at all. And that is, you know, your civil liberty. You don't want anybody to encroach on that. On the other hand, there is a larger good of larger society. And,
agreed,
you know,
yeah,
we have polices, we have securities, we have all of these things in order to ensure that the citizens can live together in peace, mm-hmm, in peace of mind. And that is more important. You know, the fabric of the society is very fragile. You know, incidents like that has very deep impact on the society. And decisions like that, whether what system needs to be implemented, is the decisions that politicians have to make.
And people like you are there to try to provide the technology.
The technology.
And what's your level of confidence that this radar system for crowd scanning that you're working on at U of M could see its way into everyday life? And how long might that take?
For this technology, the way we are right now, we have done the basic studies. You know, we have done demonstration in the lab that this technology has potential. It has not been field tested. It has not been built to a point that you can go out and use it on people. But we have shown that the basis of the technology work, the basis of the science is sound, and something that, you know, if there is interest, you know, investment can come into it and it can become another, you know, security device.
Dr. Kamal Sarabandi, part of the University of Michigan team of engineers working on a radar system for crowd scanning. He's a professor of electrical engineering and the director of the radiation laboratory at U of M. Thanks for giving us a sense, Doctor, of what goes into something that becomes a part of life eventually that we take for granted, but we lose track of all the work of folks like you in making it happen.
Thank you so very much.
Coming up, we discuss the future of online lottery sales. And then Jack Lessenberry and Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood will stop by to talk about secret work groups and just how transparent Michigan's government should be. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, here's a question for you. How would you like to buy lottery tickets online? Governor Snyder thinks you would. His administration's asking for more than $3 million to launch an online lottery in Michigan. But the plan has foes in both the State House and Senate. They're maneuvering to block online lottery ticket sales. So let's find out more as we check in with Dave Eggert, the Lansing reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome back to Stateside, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So break it down for us. What is this debate about?
You know, this all starts with the U.S. Justice Department about 16, 17 months ago issued an opinion that kind of cleared the way for states to look at online gambling, online lotteries. You know, up until then, it had kind of been off limits. There had been some murky legal questions about it. So Michigan, other states, has kind of been exploring its options. And, you know, the Michigan Lottery website, I think, is the most visited state government website by far, you know, and I think a lottery officials who are charged with trying to maximize profits, the profits from the lottery go to public schools in Michigan. You know, they see this as kind of the next frontier for them to make more money.
So what are the concerns about online lottery sales? It would certainly seem like it would be a good thing to make lottery sales easier, make more money. So what are the concerns?
Well, there's some Republicans in the legislature that are they're concerned because the main way it's all still being worked out as to how exactly it would work. But the assumption is, you know, you would since it's on the internet, you'd pay by credit card, and the concern there is just gambling addiction and other issues.
Are we hearing from store owners who are retailers who are not thrilled about people not being coming into their stores to buy tickets?
Yeah, there is some concern there. I think some of the traditional brick-and-mortar businesses are worried. Maybe this would suck business away from them. The lottery is trying to assure lawmakers that they've done some studies looking at what's happened in a few other states. And really, you just get more sales, and it's not taken away from, you know, your local convenience store or gas station. But I think there's still some skepticism there.
And that's what I was actually wondering how it's worked in other states with internet lottery sales. Is it working well? And
yeah, there's only, from what I can tell, there's only been, I think, two states that have actually done it so far. I think it's Illinois and Georgia. And some of the lawmakers say that in Illinois, the kind of anticipated profits weren't as high as expected. But it's still pretty early on, and I think, you know, as they get kinks worked out, it is a potential for extra revenue. I think Michigan's looking, you know, not a lot of additional revenue right in the first year, but over the first 4 years, they're saying they could get another $100 million+ for the school system.
So what should we watch for next, Dave, both for lottery players who might want to see this happen and for the critics who don't want to see it happen?
Well, there's a couple different avenues in the legislature right now. Like you said, the governor has asked for more than $3 million, essentially, for extra staff to help run the lottery. And the administration's also on a path where they're seeking a private vendor to kind of come in and help them set up this internet lottery system. It's called iLottery. And what's happening so far is one chamber seems okay with the idea, and the other chamber does not. So we're kind of looking to see what happens in the budget process in May. There's also some bills out there that would just outright prohibit the lottery from going down this road. Some lawmakers are worried that the lottery, you know, has a big enough budget that it could still proceed with this contract, which they're hoping to finish up by early next year. So you're not going to, as a lottery player out there, you probably wouldn't be able to start using this system until 2014 at the earliest.
We appreciate the update on the possibility of the iLottery, your internet lottery, possibly available in Michigan. Checking in with Dave Eggert, the Lansing reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you.
How public, how transparent should the process of our government be? That's the question behind the growing awareness of the use of unofficial committees created in Lansing to help design and craft policy. They're called work groups or task forces. And following the revelation of the so-called Skunk Works Education Work Group that was made public a couple of weeks ago by the Detroit News, we wanted to look at just how these work groups operate in Lansing, whether the use of these work groups has increased under Governor Snyder, and figure out if there's the possible impact on our democratic system of government. Joining us for this conversation is Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood. Welcome back, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
And Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry joins us. Hello, Jack.
Good to be here.
Good to have you both. Chad, I want to start with you because your recent piece in the Detroit News posed that question. Are these behind closed doors work groups the new normal in governing Michigan? Are they?
Well, the work groups have been around in Lansing for a long time. And as someone said after I wrote about the Skunk Works group, you know, there's a dozen Skunk Works projects in Lansing, but no one ever calls it that. That term, some people may not be familiar, actually comes from Lockheed Martin's secret development of warplanes during World War II. But that was actually what was being called in documents that I obtained from a source before we lifted the curtain on this operation. And since then, this group has now been changed. It's been put into the realm of the Department of Education, because previously there was just one appointee from the Department of Education, but the superintendent of public instruction wasn't even aware really what the group's ultimate goal was, which was to develop a new type of a charter school that they call a value school that could operate at $5,000 a kid, using more technology and fewer teachers, and something that resembles a voucher-like funding system with a sort of a debit card to pay for your education.
So, Jack, when we talk about work groups and task forces in governing, because they're nothing new, are they? I mean, could I just toss this out? Might we not say that Committee of Five that hammered out the Declaration of Independence back in 1776 was a version of a work group?
Well, I'm not sure it's a version of this kind of work group, and they knew they could lose their lives for it. I think several things are going on here. One is that if these were elected bodies or publicly appointed bodies, meeting in secret would be illegal. You have to meet in sort of and take votes in an open process. I suspect if this secret working group had been a group to reorganize the state library, say, nobody would care very much. But when you have education and the concept of vouchers or voucher-like implements, it's certainly a hot-button issue. And I think there's probably some level of discomfort with it. On the other hand, it is a perennial problem. It's a problem we see in university searches where, on the one hand, you want to have a public openness. On the other hand, say, obviously, the University of Michigan is going to be going through a search since the president is retiring.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people won't apply if they have to publicly be identified from the get-go, because if they don't get the job, it would hurt them, or they would perceive it would hurt them at their host institution. So it's a very thorny question. I don't know that these things are necessarily illegal, but some of these might have a problem with the smell test. But I'd defer to Chad. He's now sort of the ranking expert on how this works in Lansing.
Well, and in Lansing, it's pretty common to have more and more recently, especially in this era of term limits, where there aren't as many experts anymore within the legislature, in some cases even the executive branch, on a certain issue. So they'll convene a work group to kind of drill down into a subject before they bring it to a committee. Last year, there was a big work group of two lawmakers, Representative Phil Kavanaugh from Redford Township, a Democrat, and former Representative Ken Horn, a Republican from Frankenmuth. They went around the state studying the medical marijuana law in Michigan to try to figure out kind of what was wrong with it, how it needed to be improved, get input from law enforcement, from marijuana advocates, from physicians, and then try to craft some bills out of that. They had eight bills that were introduced, and they whittled it down to four or five. Then they took it to a committee, held lengthy public hearings. I mean, some people think that this is kind of more of a model of a better way of a work group than what we've kind of discovered here with this group that was formerly called the Education Reform Advisory Team that was sort of deliberately using private email addresses for public employees that were involved in it. And that's you know, pretty well-known technique by government employees to try to dodge the or skirt the Freedom of Information Act so that their emails can't be obtained by, you know, pesky reporters.
So it sounds like there's work groups and then there are work groups, because it certainly it does make sense that it takes some work to help craft policy or bills before presenting it to the world. And even as you pointed out, Jack, with university searches, I mean, there are times when you do need to have some privacy, yes?
There's that, and what you said at first is even truer, I think, here in that nobody in the legislature has very much experience. Nobody's been there longer than 4 years. So it's a good idea not to have people introducing bills all the time to invent the wheel. So you need some kind of level of sort of doing research, but there are, I believe, outfits that do legislative research. Chad, aren't there bureaus in both the House and the Senate that will help legislators draft bills?
Yeah, sure, and that's what they're there for. And then there's also just the old-fashioned system of let's hold public hearings,
right,
maybe for weeks on end, and let's generate input from people. That's obviously still being done, but sometimes in some of these big topic issues, some of the details are worked out beforehand, and it's not uncommon. And it's sort of the biggest open secret around here is that lobbyists write bills and laws around here.
I'm shocked.
Well, they outnumber the legislatures by about 10-1. So that brings up what are the motivations of the people who are on the work group? There's another work group going on right now in town that was actually formerly created kind of a special committee on public safety reforms that was formed by the governor. They're a bunch of prosecutors and police chiefs. They meet in secret, and if you try to ask what's going on, they won't say. But something that kind of came out in MERS, the publication up here, was that they were tossing around a plan to consolidate 911 centers. Well, it kind of interestingly enough, there's nobody from the 911 dispatch community represented on this panel of 15 officials from both the Snyder administration and from law enforcement and prosecutor ranks. So then you kind of have to question, well, wait a minute,
plain dumb. That's not a partisan response. It's just to have a major subject, we'd have anybody who's an expert in the subject doesn't seem very well advised to me.
Well, then that was what was going on here with Skunk Works, was they had a teacher on there and from Oakland County, and once he figured out that they were really talking about creating a parallel school system, he quit. And then they also had an accountant from Plan Moran, which works for a lot of school districts, and she quit once she figured out that that was going to be a pretty big conflict. So then they had a group that didn't really have anybody from the education community, and they specifically said we don't want anybody from the education community because we don't want them to have the opportunity to kind of muddy up this process.
You mean
that we won't
to challenge what's being talked about?
Exactly, and so then, but yes, this thing hasn't gone very far. But there's just sort of this question of sometimes around here in legislation, especially with a full Republican majority in both chambers, and then this has been done in the past as well. And on the other side, when they want to move something, a bill up here, they move it, and things can go from work groups to laws pretty quickly around here.
Well, there's a couple other things going on I think we should mention. Number one is that the level of trust is lower than it's been in quite some time, partly because if we remember last December, Governor Snyder, having said that he was right to work was not on his agenda, in his famous phrase, all of a sudden it was on his agenda, and the right to work bills are rammed through both houses in the space of a single day without any committee hearings, without anything. So there's a level of distrust, certainly among the Democrats. And second, next year is an election year, which means they're starting already to position themselves for that, and that always affects things.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking with Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood and Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry, looking at the increasing use of work groups and task forces, unofficial committees being created in Lansing to help design and craft policy. So I guess I'd like to get the thoughts from both of you. When we talk about these work groups and these task forces, what do the presence and the use of these work groups, where there really isn't any way for the public to know who or what is influencing them, what do you think that means to our system of governing?
Well, I think we need to keep an eye on it, and I think what the big worry is that a group like this one will come out with a value school plan to launch all sorts of schools online or otherwise for only $5,000 a student, present this as a fait accompli, and then have it rammed through the legislature without proper hearings, much as right to work was done. And I think if that becomes a practice it's going to raise some real questions about democracy.
And Chad?
It is about the process. So how do things become law? What is the motivation? And if you don't have time or the ability for the public to really sort of scrutinize, you know, what's going on here, and just ask basic who, what, where, and why questions, that does, you know, really raise some red flags.
You know, we forget sometimes that democracy is supposed to be messy. Dictatorships are very efficient. Everything runs on time. But the whole idea of a deliberative body like a legislature is somebody introduces a bill or an idea, and you have hearings, and somebody else says, well, the trouble with that is we tried that in Saugatuck, and everything fell apart for this reason, and so you've got some time to deliberate. And if you've, if it's all done behind closed doors, people are shut out of the process.
That summed it up, I think, pretty perfectly. I guess what I wonder is, for people listening to this who are bothered, alarmed by that, what's the takeaway? What do we do? What do we demand of our lawmakers, Jack?
Well, if I think of people, and people from both parties convey to the legislators that they don't like this, and compared to the governors, the executive office, they don't like this sort of thing, they may back off. They were certainly embarrassed. The governor's office, whether they admit it or not, was embarrassed over the revelation of the Skunk Works idea, partly because of the name, but also because of the topic. And, again, they do respond to public opinion. The trouble is it's hard to keep public opinion focused.
Chad?
Yeah, and there's actually a recent example where I think the public outrage on something actually got the legislature's attention. In this new technique of referendum proofing bills by attaching an appropriation to the bill. This was done to the Right to Work bill. It was done to the new emergency manager law after the voters repealed the last emergency manager law. They even put an appropriation on legislative redistricting to keep that from ending up on the ballot. And recently there was this bill that would help create another mechanism for hunting gray wolves in the Upper Peninsula, and the senator put a $1 million appropriation on there, couldn't hardly really explain what it was for, and got a lot of backlash for that, and ended up stripping it off himself on the Senate floor, acknowledging the backlash he got from people on this. So, you know, these guys, they do listen, especially when the phone's ringing, and they see the tea leaves.
Well, speaking out and being aware, it all comes down to that. We've been speaking with Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood and Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lesenberry. Always good to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Stateside was produced and directed today by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today, Peg Watson. And contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, and April Van Buren. I'm Cynthia Canty. We thank you so much for listening. And let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.